Comrades, is this working? Yeah? Very good to be here. We are still not over. It would appear the debates which were taking place before the United States, backed by Britain, went to war against Iraq are still going on. What staggers me is that we made it very clear throughout the period leading up to the war in the anti-war movement, not just at the big demonstrations, but all the rallies that were held here in Europe, in the United States. For us, there was no question that this whole argument about weapons of mass destruction was a fake argument. And the reason it was a fake argument was that it was obvious to anyone who cared to think that if Saddam Hussein's regime actually possessed weapons of mass destruction, they would not be invading it. I mean, think about it. If you actually believe that he possesses chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction, from which I mean, and I think most people assume, nuclear weapons, because these are weapons of mass destruction, then you don't go in and invade that country, because if these weapons exist, they'll be used. The whole point about it is that they knew they didn't exist. And they knew it from the beginning. And when it, one of the big demonstrations, I referred to them as Blair-faced liars, we knew what we were talking about. That every single member of the cabinet was involved in deception. They lied to the British people. They lied to Parliament. They are still telling the same lies. And the fact that Blair is now sounding confident, we will find them, all that can indicate is that they are actually going to plant them. Like the British police force used to plant drugs and weapons of various sorts on people they wanted to pick up, but it's not going to be easy because the whole world is watching. And one of the ways the intelligence agencies could devise to suddenly find the weapons is to actually buy off 10 or 12 very senior Iraqi officers from the previous regime who suddenly come to them and say, you know why you haven't been able to find them? Because they were hidden in this very special place, and here they are. Don't put it past them that they're probably devising some plot. But what makes it difficult for them is that the country itself is in a very turbulent state. That's the other thing. I hate normally doing this to say we warned you, but we did. We did. We said, if you take Iraq, it will not be like Bosnia and Kosovo. You will have a resistance, and that this resistance will start from very early days onwards. Said it many, many times in public. And they still were surprised. What staggers you when you read the media is the surprise. You go and occupy a country. You take it. And you're surprised that people are not happy. What is this? I mean, when the Nazis occupied large parts of Europe and a resistance began, no one was surprised a resistance began. But they're surprised that the Iraqis are able to launch a resistance. Is that it? Or is there something deeper in it? And I think that's it, that the Iraqis should really be grateful for being occupied by the United States and Britain. That's what it is. They should be grateful. Because there they were, under this regime, which the United States and Britain had armed to the hilt, for many decades, unleashed against the Iranians to fight the Iran-Iraq war, led to a million people on both sides being killed, and now they have the nerve to say, count those casualties of the war as one of the indictments against the regime, a war which they helped, and a war which they funded and armed throughout the period it took place. And everyone in Iraq knows this, and this is why some of the big slogans which have been carried on demonstrations in Baghdad and in Basra are, no to Saddam, no to America. Thank you. And they assumed that this was a country without a past, without a history, without a culture, without an intelligence, that people were stupid, that the minute they walked in they would be received with tears and flowers, with sweets and flowers and people jumping on them. Well, you know, people are jumping in them, but not in the way they imagine. Because they weren't prepared for it. It's obvious if you look at their faces. If you see the first reports which were sent out after they went in, British journalists from the Financial Times and other papers, incredibly surprised at the hostility they encountered. And there was one very interesting report sent in by a journalist who actually knows Arabic and so could hear what the kids were saying to the Marines with whom they were photographed. And in many cases, this journalist reported that these kids used to bet with each other, toss a coin or something to see who would be the person, the kid, to go and shake hands with a Marine, smile, have their photograph taken, and say in Arabic, "We hate you, you motherfucker." Is it surprising? We've seen it all before. Not so far away from Iraq. I mean, it was the children, the kids, the young who unleashed the Intifada, both the first one and the second one. Because kids are fearless. That is a quality they have. Apart from their innocence, they also have no fear. That is the arrogance of youth, and very young children at that. They feel no one can touch them, they can do what they want. And some of the images coming out of Iraq are precisely of American tanks being stoned by young kids. So if the only way I think they will be able to run Iraq in the immediate future is through a mixture of the methods they've employed in Gaza and Guantanamo. Some of the houses of Iraqi oppositionists which are now being wrecked, if you look at the photographs coming out, this is the house which produced the guy who came and took a pot shot at us, and to punish him, we're going to knock the whole house down, what the Israelis have been doing in the occupied territories. So you do that, fine, because that's the logic of occupation. It has no other logic. When there is a colonial occupation of a country, this is how colonial occupiers behave. There is no other way they can behave. So we shouldn't be surprised. They would like to behave in another way, but that behavior depends on the population. And the population in Iraq is completely hostile to them. That's become very clear. The fact that they haven't been able to organize a puppet government, the fact that the people they brought with them on planes from the United States, Ahmed Chalabi and his gang, are now back in the United States. He didn't last long. And it's very interesting. A poetic duel fought between, not fought, it was a friendly duel between two Iraqi poets. Because one thing you have to understand about this culture, it has produced some of the finest poets in the Arab language. And three of the great poets of the 20th century were all communist poets. Sadi Yusuf, Muzaffar al-Nawab, al-Jawahiri. Al-Jawahiri was the oldest of them. He died in 97, aged 100. The other two are in their 70s, relatively young, they tell me. But all three of them had this history of struggle. And Jawahiri's poem, one of his most epic poems he wrote in the 1940s in Iraq, when there was an insurrection against the British occupation, and they wanted to break the treaties with Britain and get the British out of Iraq, and Al-Jawahiri's brother was one of the young students crossing the bridge, which is now called the Bridge of Martyrs, when there were troop emplacements out saying you can't cross the bridge, and a whole pile of students and young people said we will cross it, and they were shot. Dozens and dozens of students were shot that day in Baghdad. And Jawahiri's brother came to the poet and died in his arms, bleeding to death. And Jawahiri wrote a poem about the horizon being red with blood. And every Iraqi knew that poem, because poetry travels like nothing else. You can learn it. It can be recited. You don't have to know even how to read to learn a poem. So he goes back to that generation. And this is what both the imperialist ideologues and their stooges in the media forgot. That this is a country with a history. And it's not an old history. It's a relatively recent history because the country only came into being in 1920. And so there are generations still there who know from personal experience, and others because they have heard it from whom they had, who had personal experience, of what the struggle was like in the 20s and the 40s against the occupying power, which was then the British. And for Tony Blair to agree to become America's attack dog yet again in this bloody conflict is a sign of being completely unaware of your own past as an imperial power in that region. Did no one explain to these people what the history of Iraq was or what they had done there? But these two poets who are still alive belonged to different factions of the Iraqi Communist Party. They were friends, close friends, and still are, and now of course they are very close because they are not in any faction. But they are still communists and see themselves as that. And when, a month before the war began, there was a meeting in London, you will recall, of the Iraqi National Congress, where they were going to discuss what to do with Iraq. And one of the poets, who's in exile in Iraq, I asked him when I met him, where do you live? He said, I live in Uxbridge to be close to Heathrow Airport, you know, in case we have to leave quickly. Which reminded me of a Brecht poem about his exile, saying we always used to live close to railway stations in case we had to rush. So he wrote a poem called The Jackal's Wedding. And he described this conference taking place in London as a jackal's wedding. And he explained to me when I met him, he said, you know, in southern Iraq especially, in the summer months we sleep out of doors underneath the sky to see the stars as we sleep. And once a month, sometimes once every 2 months, there's a big assembly of jackals. They mate, they make a mess, they make a noise, the stench is unbearable, and the whole village wakes up. And the next morning they've gone, but people have a bad memory and they say, oh God, did you hear that jackal's wedding last night? So he said, these people gathering here for me are like a jackal's wedding. And he wrote a poem which he addressed to his fellow poet, Muzaffar al-Nawab, in exile in Damascus. I can't remember the exact words. It's something like this. Muzaffar al-Nawab, my lifelong comrade, the jackals are having a wedding again. What are we going to do? And he ends up by saying, you are far away in Syria, but I am close to the wedding. And look, this is the invitation they've sent for the reception. I will go in the name of both of us and spit on them, and spit on their papers, and tell them Iraq belongs to us, who have always been happy living underneath a hut made of bamboos. We do not want the Westerners there. And this poem circulated, that's the interesting thing. It circulated throughout Iraq. Within 2 weeks, everyone was reciting it. And the right-wing Iraqi exile press had been denouncing these two poets in their press for ages, saying they're communists, they're not proper Iraqis, they're traitors, etc., etc. It has absolutely no impact at all. So there you have the culture of a country playing a big role from the outside, actually influencing what is going on inside. Now, the other poet then sent a reply in a poem, the essence of which was, don't submit and don't begin the armed struggle unless you have any arms. We've been through that one before. And he attacks those people. He says there are two sorts of Iraqis. There are those Iraqis who will fight with their tongues. There are those Iraqis who will fight with guns. But then there's another breed of Iraqis. They will march on their streets with the knives and forks because all they're thinking about is their stomachs, and these are the ones who they'll play on. So these debates are not only going on between poets, but are going on inside Iraq itself, because it's over a month now well over a month since that country was occupied. None of the basic amenities of that society have been restored. Neither electricity nor water. And there will be casualties. There will be casualties. People will die. Sanctions were bad enough. This is now turning out to be much, much worse than anyone thought. And Western journalists are beginning to write about ordinary people saying, at the end of the 1991 Gulf War, when our infrastructure was destroyed, it took the Ba'ath regime 2 weeks to set everything right. 2 weeks. And we had our water supply again and basic electricity supplies. Not all the time, but for hours each day. But they can't do it. And the reason they can't do it is because they don't have a state there. They've dismantled the state. They've destroyed the state. They've wrecked everything. They have no one to carry out the tasks which need to be carried out to preserve a semblance of everyday life, normality in that country. That is not happening, and that is increasing the attraction of the resistance. Now, who's resisting? Is it just the remnants of the Ba'athist apparatus? No. That's what they want to say. And that's what they push down the media and the television screens. It's not true. The resistance in the South is not coming from the remnants of the Ba'ath state apparatus. There are elements of them in Baghdad and especially in Fallujah, cities on the Tigris. But in the regions of the mid-Euphrates, which have had a strong tradition of resistance, and not just Shiite resistance, as they tell us, but communist resistance. Basra, Nasiriyah, Diwana, Amara, where the British soldiers were killed, these were areas where the Iraqi communist movement has been very strong for 20, 25 years. Strong peasant organizations, strong trade union organizations. So there is a history of resistance in these regions. They're very hostile to the Ba'ath. So that is essentially what is happening in the country, that you have the first rudimentary beginnings of a resistance. It is low-intensity guerrilla warfare. That is what is going on. Basically, the aim of the resistance is to make sure they kill one occupying soldier a day. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't, sometimes they over-exceed their target. And I'll be very honest with you. I'm very pleased they are. It would be absolutely appalling and depressing if there was no resistance to this. Think about it. If there was no resistance at all, it would be awful. Just imagine if these people had been welcomed in. But they haven't been. And the resistance is going to take many, many different forms. There will be an armed resistance, which is happening. There will be a political resistance, which is also happening. It's just an amazing scene. I don't know, about several weeks ago, there was an unusual film, you know, which is rare, on Channel 4, showing the war we didn't see. And in this, they had footage from people there, amateur photographers, making films. And there were two different items they showed in that film, both of them very revealing. One was a whole group of American Marines who've captured one Iraqi who's thrown on the ground, and they're just kicking the life out of him. Just random brutality. Not unlike the scene we saw several years ago of the police kicking a black American in L.A., very similar, actually, in terms of how they were doing it. Not to kill him, but to humiliate him, to hurt him. God knows what he'd done, maybe abused them, who knows. But this was filmed. And suddenly, as they saw the cameraman from a bombed building, they turned their machine guns on him and let rip. So, you know, he ran. Correctly so. But he got the film. The second sight we saw, again filmed semi-clandestinely, was a whole big demonstration outside the American barracks. And here you had a strange scene. Most of the people were shouting in Arabic, and a black American soldier came out and spoke to them, to the demonstrators, and said, you should go, you know, we've liberated you, you should go. And there was one kid who must have been 16 or 17 years old who spoke English, who just kept saying, leave our country, we hate you. And every time the American spoke, he just replied in that monotone voice, get out of our country, we hate you, we don't want you here. And the American said, we've given you liberty, and he said, we hate you. Get out of our country, at which point the soldier lost his temper and said, if you carry on talking like that, I'm going to drag you in and there we'll show you. So the liberty didn't last too long on this occasion. Now, what is going on in Iraq is going to, I think, be very decisive. If the Americans succeed in imposing their weight on the country, crushing all the opposition, imposing a puppet regime, privatizing everything, taking the oil, and resistance is wiped out, it will be a big defeat. A big, big defeat. Have no doubt about it. A defeat which will affect that entire world. But if the resistance begins to take off, and actually begins to score victories, and if it succeeds in doing what happened in Beirut when American soldiers went in there, and there are big attacks on barracks with occupying troops, and they begin to lose not one soldiers in one or twos, but actually begin to lose 100 or 200 at one go, that will have an effect, and they know that. And because they know that, they are pleading with other governments now to send in their armies. And who are they pleading with? India, Pakistan, Nepal. They've not denuded the country enough. They've got Gurkhas there already. But they want the Nepali army to send in a few more. And the Nepali government, let's start with that one first, is totally, at the moment, there's a state of truce. But it's one of those countries where we've had a, you know, I don't want to be insulting, but a sort of semi-retro armed struggle going on for many years, led by a Maoist organization, whose initial position was that it wanted Nepal to become a province in the People's Republic of China. When the Chinese said, these people have got nothing to do with us, they changed their position. But they are very courageous, these armed guerrilla fighters, and they've captured half the country. And because they've had a truce, the Nepali government recently said, yesterday we are considering sending some soldiers to go and fight in Iraq. I would appeal to the Maoist comrades in Nepal, end your truce. End it now and say that if soldiers are sent to fight in Iraq and kill Iraqis, we'll take the country. They could take Nepal, you know. The reason they haven't taken it is because they say it might provoke an American intervention, which we don't want. But if they're taking the army away into Iraq, my advice is take Nepal, deal with the Americans later. The other two countries, who are they requesting help from? Pakistan, which is nervous, because they know if they send in Pakistani troops who are involved in killing Iraqis, there will be a big backlash. They don't want to do it. So General Musharraf is saying, look, we have problems here. You've got into Afghanistan. We have the Islamists who are struggling. Why don't you hand the country over to the United Nations and then we might think about it? But that's not what they want to do. They don't want to hand it to the UN. Not that it would make all that much difference anyway, but they don't want to do that. So they are still putting. Then when the Pakistanis refused to supply soldiers, they went to Pakistan's principal rival in the region and said to the Indian government, you send our soldiers. And the Indian government is seriously considering this. But I have some advice, a modest proposal for the Indian government. Be very foolish of you if you sent your army into Iraq, a predominantly Muslim country, to go and do this. But if you are desperate to be part of the imperial operation, here's an idea for you. Why not establish a non-military brigade, the Narendra Modi Brigade, from Gujarat. This is the Chief Minister of Gujarat. Send his police force, get them out of Gujarat, where they basically kill unarmed, innocent Muslims and carry out pogroms of them and are re-elected. Go into Iraq where you'll face the people who's armed. Think about it. I might write George Fernandez an open letter. He once used to be a railway worker strike leader. Now he's a corrupt Minister of Defense. But I might write him an open letter giving him this advice totally free of charge. I don't want any money for it. Saying send in the Narendra Modi brigade from Gujarat to go and fight and kill Muslims there. Some of them will resist. We have to give that as a warning. So these countries who have historically, their armies have been used during the colonial period. Do you know there were Indian troops which helped to take Iraq in 1920? There were Indian troops present when they went to crush the Boxers Rebellion in China. There were Indian troops present when they went to crush the uprising in Hanoi in 1945. So have some shame, we say to the leaders of these two countries. We are no longer living in a colonial world. Or are we? Because what is now happening is that the occupation of Iraq is making many people say this is the only way to go. We people there can't do anything for themselves, so we go and occupy countries. And we can't occupy countries which actually have nuclear weapons, but we can go and sort out the rest of the world. And let me tell you something, that the arguments in this are not new either. If you want to read arguments which make Blair look quite mild, read a Fabian pamphlet, which was written at the end of the 19th century by Bernard Shaw. Read the pronouncements of the Fabian wing of the Labour Party justifying and defending imperialism as the right of a superior civilization to act in its own interests. Read what the German Social Democrats wrote at the beginning of the 20th century. The native people who live on the lands have no automatic rights to these lands if they are in battle against a superior civilization. That is what Edward Bernstein wrote. It was defeated by the German Social Democratic Party, but these ideas were very strong. So we shouldn't be surprised when we find so many members, and certainly the leaders of the British Labour Party, justifying the new model imperialism. It is in their genes. That's why they're genetically coded. They've done it before. They never opposed imperialism. The notion that these countries were given their freedom and independence by the 1945 Labour government is bullshit. They were given their freedom and independence because there were mass movements in all these countries who demanded their freedom and independence. And the American Empire, which has now decided to bear its fangs, has been an empire for a long time. It's not the first time. And this is a history which predates the Russian Revolution. So the stupid argument that they became imperialists to fight Russia is just nonsense. The last big occupation the Americans carried out was almost exactly 100 years ago today. 103. 1898, when they occupied the Philippines. And there too they were surprised that there was a resistance. They needed a big base in the Pacific. They made an excuse, we're coming to help the Filipinos fight against the Spaniards. The Spaniards had virtually sold the island to them in any way. Which it was sold by the Spanish finally, the Philippines, to the United States. And they went in there, and they assumed there would be no resistance. And they were shocked, just like they are now, by the resistance of the Filipinos. And 5,000 white American soldiers were killed because their army was predominantly white. If not exclusively white. It was predominantly white. 5,000 of them were killed. And they then took their revenge out on the Filipino people. 20,000 Filipino soldiers resisting died. 200,000 people died of famine, starvation, plague, disease. 100 years ago. And they occupied the Philippines, and then they created this oligarchy of hacienda owners, which ran the country for them, continuously. And when it collapsed, they put Marcos in, who established an iron dictatorship. And the interesting thing is, for people who have doubts about the empire, just think about it. Liberation, they say? Are the Filipinos still liberated? That when they can't trust Iraqis to come and clean their barracks and do the menial tasks in the apparatus they're setting up, they are importing Filipino migrants to come and do the work because they can be trusted and they are cheaper. So the colonization of 100 years ago is still being utilized to strengthen and buttress a process of recolonization which is taking place in Iraq. This is the history of this empire. And the notion that, you know, once again people are surprised, oh God, the Americans are admitting they're an empire. Well, look, they may not have admitted it, but it was crystal clear for everyone to see from what they did to Latin America. And the effect, I mean, there's an amazing, some of the photographs I've been, when I was working on my book, I wanted to see some images. So I got these photographs, and some of them are truly incredible. When you see a photograph of Bush in a golf cart in Egypt, and sitting next to him, and Bush is in the driver's seat of the golf cart, and sitting next to him is this moth-eaten Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, and sitting behind is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And you just look at their faces. Or you look at another picture of Bush standing in the middle, one side the king of Jordan, the other side the king of Saudi Arabia, and then Hosni Mubarak. This is the sum total of U.S. support in the region, because they cannot, of course, bring Ariel Sharon in to pose for photographs, because then that would become too obvious. But he's the missing person. He's the missing person. And essentially what they are now trying to do is use the occupation of Iraq to get the Palestinians to make another big concession to them in the name of this so-called roadmap, which if those of you who have been following events, most Israeli peaceniks and people on the Israeli left as well as the Palestinian left have been denouncing endlessly since it started yesterday. Abu Mazen, the new Prime Minister of so-called Prime Minister of Palestine, was almost expelled from Al-Fatah, the organization which allowed him to become that, on the grounds that he was just making too many concessions which were unacceptable. Unacceptable even to Fatah, to his own organization. So what they want to do is create a set of Hamid Karzais all over the world where they're trying to maneuver and manipulate. And all we can say is these things are like sticking plaster. They can work for a bit. They can stop the bleeding for a tiny bit, but sooner or later they come off. And they cannot heal the wounds. It doesn't work unless the real problems are addressed. Now, are the Iraqis going to be happy that a society which they knew, which repressive though it was, gave them certain basic amenities in terms of living, in terms of food subsidies, that instead of that, awful though it was, they are now going to have a totally privatized society where the poorer are going to get poorer by the minute, and their oil is going to be taken? And are the Palestinians going to be made happy by this big wall being constructed so they can't travel from one part of Palestine to another? Just to look at it knows it's not going to work. And I think we have to carry on, comrades. I mean, you know, these are difficult times for us. We have to carry on. We have to say we were totally right to have opposed this war. It's beginning to unravel now even in the filthy lying faces of British politicians. We were right to do that, but we've now got to move a step further. We have to now organize and bring Iraqis who are leading the resistance, who are fighting it, poets, politicians, whoever, and take them round. Let them speak, let them say what is going on in Iraq. Because it's not, and that will surprise people too, that, oh God, there are Iraqis who speak like that, who can tell us what's going on, who can explain why they are resisting, and why they have to resist. And I, for one, hope that this resistance gets better and better and stronger, and they continue to harry the occupying armies till they have no option but to withdraw. And meanwhile... Meanwhile, those of us who live here or in the United States of America or in other parts of Europe have to keep the pressure up. It won't be the same. It can never be the same. Mass movements, whether they are anti-war or any other sort of mass movements, always go up and down in waves. It's foolish to think you can pull out a million people every single month or once or even 6 months. That's not the story. The story is to make sure that just as the resistance inside Iraq carries on its low-intensity warfare, we carry on with our low-intensity political warfare against this regime and the United States and the Europeans who have now jumped on the bandwagon.